The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'm reading articles first from the Harvard Health Letter and then from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And first, I'm going to conclude the news briefs from the June 2022 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And this is a section called, What's the Best Sleep Position to Combat Heartburn? It's hard to fall asleep at night when heartburn is your frequent bed partner. How can you give it the boot? In addition to elevating your upper body with a wedge pillow, avoiding meals close to bedtime, and taking heartburn medications, a small study suggests that sleeping on your left side may help. Those findings were published in the February 2022 issue of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. A total of 57 people with chronic heartburn were monitored during sleep, spending about the same amount of time on their left side, right side, or back. The positions didn't make a difference in the number of times participants experienced stomach acid backing up into the esophagus, which causes heartburn pain. But the acid cleared much faster when participants were on their left side, as opposed to their back or their right side. Less exposure to acid can reduce heartburn pain and also reduce the risk of tissue damage and more serious problems. Next, we're going to talk about what are the different types of body fat. And this comes from Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2022. I hear there are different types of fat in your body, some good for you and some not. Could I be a lucky person who has only the good kind? Unfortunately, Dr. Komaroff says, no one has only the good kind, but most of us have at least some. Over the past 30 years, we've learned a lot about fat. We used to think it was mainly insulation against the cold. In fact, it's a lot more. When I was a medical student beginning to dissect a cadaver in the anatomy lab, I was amazed by how much fat there was. But my anatomy textbooks didn't show any of it. The bones, muscles, blood vessels, nerves, and organs were all there, just no fat. It was as if the anatomy book artists had performed liposuction before starting to draw. They thought fat was uninteresting and irrelevant. A modern-day description of fat is provided in an article by Dr. Aaron Sipes of the National Institutes of Health, published February 24, 2022, in the New England Journal of Medicine. He explains how fat, or adipose tissue, contains not only cells full of fat, but also blood vessels, nerves, and immune system cells. The most common type of adipose tissue is white adipose tissue, or white fat, which is located in the chest, abdomen, and upper legs. Too much of it is obesity. White fat does more than provide insulation against the cold. Like a rechargeable battery, it also stores fat derived from food and continually releases small amount of fats to be converted into energy. We need that constant supply of energy to function. If we couldn't store and continuously release sources of energy, we would have to constantly eat. If we had to do that, we'd get even less done in a day. Brown adipose tissue, or brown fat, is found in the neck, the shoulders, the chest, and the abdomen, in small quantities, less than a hundredth of the amount of white fat. Its main function is to burn the fats it stores, creating heat that keeps us warm. There's other types of fat tissues as well with different functions. Adipose tissue also makes many hormones, including some that affect our appetite, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol. It also makes immune system molecules that can affect the degree of inflammation in our bodies. The healthiest profile is to have relatively more brown fat and relatively less white fat than average. At this time, measurement of the amount of both brown and white fat in our body is not routinely available, nor do we know how to increase the amount of brown fat. We do know how to reduce the amount of white fat. The next article from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2022 is entitled, Rowing or Paddling After Age 60. If you're new to these sports or if you're returning to the water after time in dry dock, you'll want to know the risks. There's something quite satisfying about dipping an oar or paddle into the water and pulling your craft along the surface. It is hard work, but it produces tangible results moving from here to there. And when you add the calming element of nature and the camaraderie of working with others, rowing or paddling winds up being a great physical workout. Still, there are some risks to consider. A variety of water sports involve either rowing or paddling. Rowing can be done with one or two oars. You can row in a long boat called a shell that accommodates 2, 4, or 8 people. You operate just one oar in that setup, or you can operate 2 oars in a smaller boat called a scull that accommodates 1, 2, or 4 people. Paddling refers to water sports that use paddles. Single paddles, which have a flat blade at one end, are used for canoeing, dragon boat racing with 10 or 20 people in a long canoe-like boat adorned with a dragon head and tail, and paddleboarding, standing or kneeling solo on a paddleboard, which looks like a wide surfboard. A double paddle, which has a blade at both ends, is used in kayaking. Types of kayaks range from wide, flat, recreational kayaks to long, skinny, streamlined kayaks called surf skis. Rowing and paddling have many health benefits. They work your heart and lungs. Aerobic exercise helps to build endurance and promote cardiovascular health, mobility, better mood, and sharp cognition. They use lots of muscle groups. The activities are good for strength and coordination. Rowing mainly uses the leg and back, while paddling uses the core muscles to generate power for propulsion. Paddleboarding works the muscles in the buttocks and the side of the trunk and improves standing balance, explains Denise Frost, a longtime sculler, physical therapist, and director of movement health at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. Rowing and paddling promote socializing. Spending time with others counters isolation and loneliness, which are associated with chronic disease and premature death. They also help manage stress. Exercising and spending time in nature wards off chronic stress, a contributor to chronic inflammation, chronic disease, and premature death. While you might have jumped into a boat years ago, you need to use more caution now and consider the physical risks of rowing or paddling. These sports have a repetitive component. Paddling can stress the shoulder tendons. Rowing can lead to low back strain. Neither sport is a good idea if you already have tendinitis of the shoulder, elbow, or wrist, a diagnosed back problem like a disc injury, or spinal stenosis, or previous back surgery. The sports might also be risky if you're not a good swimmer, if you haven't exercised for a long time, or if you have a chronic heart or lung condition. Check with your doctor before getting involved in either sport. If you're interested in paddling or rowing, Frost says, paddling might be the smarter way to go, since it can be as easy or demanding as you make it. Rowing, however, has a longer learning curve and is more physically demanding than paddling. You'll need to be in good shape to try it. You should also wear sunblock and sunglasses. Stay hydrated, and during the summer, restrict your participation to early mornings and late afternoons to avoid getting overheated. If you want to try paddling, Frost recommends renting the type of boat that interests you and taking a lesson to see if you like it. For dragon boat racing or rowing, Frost says, it'd be best to join a local club that offers introductory courses and could place you in a boat with similarly experienced teammates. And even though paddling and rowing may look easy, remember that it takes time to learn a new skill. You may feel strain and stiffness in many parts of your body as it adapts to new demands and forces. So start slowly with shorter sessions and build up your tolerance. Now here's a apropos article from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2022. It's entitled, Older Age Makes You Vulnerable to Summer Heat. Long hot summers are getting longer and hotter and could continue on this path as a result of global warming, according to a research published in the March 28, 2021 issue of Geophysical Research Letters. Scientists found that autumns, winters, and springs have gotten shorter over the last 60 years, and summers have increased by 20 days. Among the many concerns this brings, one is increased risk for heat-related health problems, especially as we get older. Your ability to function relies on maintaining a core internal body temperature. In a hot environment, your temperature starts to rise. Your body releases heat by sweating and carrying blood away from the body's core to the skin surface, where heat leaves the body. But those functions don't work as well when you're older. Heat can build up, putting your organs at risk, says Dr. Kalpana Shankar, director of the Geriatric Emergency Medicine Service at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. As you release heat, you also release fluid, not just from sweating, but also through your breath and evaporation through your skin, even when you can't see it. In a hot environment, with a constant need to release body heat, you can become dehydrated. We're already prone to being dehydrated in older age. Your fluid intake may be low because of a decreased sensation of thirst and hunger, Dr. Shankar says. And taking certain medications like diuretics promotes fluid loss. Yet, the body requires fluid to continue releasing heat to lower your core temperature. And so the cycle repeats itself, causing heat to build up quickly inside of you. Heat exposure increases the risk for two serious conditions. One is heat exhaustion, a warning that you're dehydrated and struggling to cool down, mild confusion, as well as dizziness and excess sweating, paleness, muscle cramps, fatigue, headache, thirst, weakness, imbalance, or nausea. Your skin may also feel cold or clammy, and you can feel that you're breathing faster and that your heart is racing. The other condition is heat stroke, which occurs when the body has completely lost its ability to regulate core temperature. The body temperature rises rapidly to 106 degrees, and the body can no longer sweat. Warning signs include temperature of 103 degrees or higher, hot and dry skin that's not sweating, a very fast heart rate, severe headaches, passing out, and severe confusion. Heat stroke is a medical emergency. Without immediate treatment, it can lead to organ damage and to death. Dr. Shankar recommends the following steps to ward off heat-related health problems. First, you need to stay hydrated. Drink lots of water before going outside and then during outdoor activities. Avoid caffeinated beverages and alcohol, which can make you more dehydrated. Remember that you can also get fluids from eating foods high in water content, like cucumbers, watermelon, lettuce, and strawberries. Go outside before or after the daily high temperature. Whether it's your daily walk, your yard work, or another outdoor activity, do it before or after the sun is high in the sky and temperatures are at their hottest. Be sure to dress the part. Wear lightweight and light-colored clothing when you go outside so your clothing do not absorb the heat. Wear sunblock and sunglasses too. Try to look for shade. Head for the shade when outdoors, or use an umbrella labeled as providing UV protection. Seek an air-conditioned environment or take a cool bath or shower, and try to limit your strenuous activity. And always stay alert. Watch for signs of heat intolerance, Dr. Shankar warns, and don't be fooled just because you're not sweating. If you have any symptoms, get a cool drink and call for help. This article has an associated section called Your Daily Water Needs. Divide your body weight in pounds by 3 to find out how many ounces of water you need every day. For example, a 150-pound person needs 50 ounces or 6 cups of fluid every day. If you're on water pills or your doctor wants you to limit your fluid intake, ask how much water you can drink when you're outdoors or you're in a hot environment with limited ventilation or air conditioning, says Dr. Kalpana Shankar, Director of Geriatric Emergency Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. And increase your water intake if you have signs of dehydration, like dark urine or a dry mouth. The next article is entitled, Is It Okay to Use Proton Pump Inhibitors on Demand? It depends on your health and the frequency of symptoms, but it can be done in certain instances. Again, this comes from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2022. Proton pump inhibitors are effective treatments for chronic heartburn caused by gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD. Several, such as omeprazole, which is also called Prilosec, lansoprazole, or Prevacid, and esomeprazole, or Nexium, are available over-the-counter as well as by prescription. But they don't rapidly relieve symptoms like two other classes of heartburn drugs, antacids and H2 blockers. That's important to understand when your doctor says you can take PPIs on demand. How do PPIs work? PPIs stifle the production of stomach acid. This is important in GERD, which occurs when stomach acid and digestive enzymes squirt back up or reflux into the esophagus, the tube that carries food from the mouth to the stomach. The stomach juices irritate and inflame the esophagus lining, causing heartburn, a burning feeling in the chest, as well as a bitter taste in the mouth, difficulty swallowing, a sore throat, or coughing. Over time, GERD can cause permanent damage to the esophagus and increase the risk of esophageal cancer. PPIs help by lowering stomach acid levels, which relieves heartburn and reduces the risk of esophageal damage. A usual course of PPIs lasts 2 to 8 weeks, depending on what your doctor prescribes. The drugs are taken once a day on an empty stomach, 30 to 60 minutes before breakfast. Your doctor might also recommend taking a PPI before a big meal. But you don't get immediate relief from a PPI. You have to stick to the daily drug regimen and give it a few days to start working, says Dr. Kyle Stoller, a gastroenterologist with Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. You can help the process by avoiding foods and drinks that trigger your heartburn. Also by not smoking and not eating close to bedtime. Now, stopping PPI therapy can get tricky. Going cold turkey can lead to heartburn that's worse than it was before PPI therapy. That's called rebound phenomenon. The PPI turns off the acid production, but when you stop the PPI, acid production gets turned back on suddenly, and that leads to symptoms. To avoid rebound, you should taper off PPIs slowly. If you're on a high dose, go to a lower dose for a few days. Then start an overlap period where you alternate a PPI one day and an H2 blocker the next. For example, you might use the H2 blockers Pepcid or Tagamet. After a week of overlap, stop the PPI altogether and take the H2 blocker each day for another week. Then stop the medication and see how you feel. The way to treat recurring symptoms depends on the type of GERD you have. If GERD has damaged the lining of your esophagus, you'll likely need to stay on a long-term PPI regimen to reduce the risk for further damage. People who don't have such damage from GERD can use PPIs on demand. While you might take H2 blockers to rapidly suppress GERD symptoms, just one or two at a time, that's not the way to use PPIs. It's usually at least a 2-week course, Dr. Stoller says. You probably won't need to taper off the drugs in this case, but you may need to experiment and see what works best for you. If this round of PPIs treats your heartburn, you can go off them again. If your symptoms persist, you may need to think about long-term maintenance therapy. And there's an associated short segment that's entitled, Are PPIs Safe? You may have heard that PPIs are associated with dangerous side effects. In the past, small studies suggested the drugs might reduce levels of vitamin B12, magnesium, and calcium, and increase the risk for hip fracture, pneumonia, kidney, or cardiovascular disease. But large studies published in 2019 and 2020 found no links to such risks. The new studies are more reliable and show no evidence of adverse outcomes, at least in a 3-year period, Dr. Kyle Stoller says. He's a gastroenterologist with the Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. But if you don't have any symptoms and you don't have any damage in your esophagus due to heartburn, there's no reason to continue taking PPIs. I'm going to start a section that's called What to Do When Your Kids Confront You About Your Health. You've spent most of your life worrying about your children's health, and it can feel uncomfortable and unfamiliar when the roles are reversed. That may be the case if your adult children express concerns that you're having a hard time walking, driving, or remembering details. How do you respond? Here's some advice from Dr. Abby Altman, a geriatric psychologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital, and Dr. Suzanne Salomon, associate chief of gerontology at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess. What should you keep in mind? These conversations often come from a place of concern and love. Your children value your life and your being in this world as long as possible. Also, your health and related treatment have an impact on the entire family unit. Ultimately, you are the one who makes the choices that can affect your health, but your children might have other perspectives on the best ways to keep you well. It's worth listening to their ideas. But what if it feels intrusive? In my work with families, I encourage parents to consider what is in their control in these interactions with their adult children and what is not. You cannot turn off the worries and feedback your children have about your health. And truly, it's nice that they care, but you always have the right to express how concerns are communicated to you and the right to take on the situation without their help, Altman points out. Parents' reactions run the entire gamut. You have some parents who are thrilled their kids want to get involved, but some don't want that. Just yesterday, I had an 88-year-old lady who left her adult child in the waiting room. She wanted me to speak only with her. Unfortunately, the people who don't want their kids involved are often the ones who actually need the help and the support of their kids. So we'll go on with that article later, because it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.